Novelist Meg Waite Clayton began practicing corporate law, but her identity as an author could not be suppressed. The Language of Light was her first book, followed by the best-selling The Wednesday Sisters, a book club word-of-mouth sensation. And now she's just released The Four Ms. Bradwells. It's a tale filled with scandal and mystery, bonds of friendship amidst women's changing roles. Meg Waite Clayton in conversation with Rosemary Manchester in just a moment. In the second half of the broadcast, we have another Manchester. It's Peter Manchester. He's an incredible painter, a commercial illustrator, and now a best-selling author of two books. You'll hear my conversation with Peter Manchester, along with author Barbara Quick's review of Gary Steingart's super sad true love story. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a novel idea. Stay tuned.
Good evening, and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester. Meg, it's such a pleasure to have you in the studio.
It's all my pleasure to be here, Rosemary. Thank you.
I'd like to take a little time to explore the four main characters. It's unusual to have a novel with four protagonists. That's quite a challenge. Four women attorneys.
It was quite a challenge to write that, to be honest. I love the ensemble novel. Mm-hmm. I love reading it. I love the idea that I have a number of characters who I can pick from to relate to. Mm-hmm. As a writer, I like it because it allows me to explore in depth four different lives, and that keeps life interesting. But this is four first-person point of view narrators. And so when the reader is reading them, they're reading Mia as an I character, and then they're reading Ginger as an I character, and it can get tangled up. It took a lot of work to try to make their voices distinct mm-hmm. enough.
Yeah. You used the group novel you wrote The Wednesday Sisters, one of your earlier books, which has been a tremendous success, especially with book clubs.
Thank you. It has. I've just been delighted at the success of that book, and that mm-hmm. is an ensemble novel, and it was my first foray into ensemble novels. I'm actually working on a third now for Random House Ballantine. We'll publish it next year.
Well, that's good news.
That's great news.
And so these four very, very strong characters, four women attorneys who met in law school, and let's take a little time to explore your characters because they're very, very interesting. Women. Let's talk about Mia.
The first section is narrated from the point of view of Mia. Mm-hmm. She is one of the four roommates they all met in law school. Mm-hmm. And Mia has come back to see her friend Betts be confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. And she was in Madagascar when she got the call.
She was in Madagascar when she got the call. There's mm-hmm. a nice little scene at the beginning of the book where she says, Madagascar, you know that's off the coast of Africa, right, Betts? Because Betts has asked her to come all the way home from Madagascar. Mm-hmm. She's actually on her way home anyway. Mm-hmm. But Mia is a foreign correspondent. She's somebody who started law school, finished law school, mm-hmm. went to practice law with a firm for a few years, and went off to travel after she and her husband split very soon after she graduated from law school. Ends up in Africa at a time when something really interesting is happening, and she's one of few Americans there who could report on it. Mm-hmm. She reports on it and ends up in a career as a foreign correspondent as a result of that very random incident. Mm-hmm. So her life is a little bit about exploring the randomness of life mm-hmm. sometimes.
All these four women are extremely bright and extremely articulate. And you distinguish Mia as the savant because she's unusually bright, but also has the ability to recall a lot of esoteric information. They kind of use her as their encyclopedia.
Yes. And the other thing about Mia, and I think the reason really that I named her as the savant, is that she often knows things without realizing that she knows them. And that's just where her nickname came from.
Okay. Let's talk about Betts, who's the candidate for the Justice of the Supreme Court. You distinguish her as the funny one.
Betts is the one who is always making jokes and stirring up trouble to a certain amount. I really like that about her. She is not my friend Jen Duchesne from law school, but my friend Jen Duchesne was very much the funny one, always making us all laugh, and so she's a small nod to her. She's a character who comes from a much less typical background than the other three Ms. Bradwells do to get to law school. She's an immigrant. Her mother brought her from Poland when she was a baby. She grew up very poor in Hamtramck, which is a town outside of Detroit, and she works very hard to get where she is. Mm-hmm. She has a daughter. She was married. Her husband died when she was young, and so many of the choices she's made in life have been to make sure that her daughter has a good life while she continues to have a career. So instead of going into some particularly high-powered job of one sort or another, she comes back to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where the four went to law school and becomes a professor. It allows her time with her child while she still has a meaningful career.
Mm-hmm. And then Lainey, who's described as the good girl. Her name is Helen Robeson Wheels. And Lainey is a candidate for governor.
She's actually a candidate for Georgia State Senate.
Oh, the State Senate, pardon me, yes.
Exactly. She is the one person who did not go into a law firm out of, well, no, actually two of them did not go into a law firm out of law school. She actually never practiced law. She went into politics out of law school behind the scenes. And at the opening of the book, it's the first time that she has actually stepped out from behind the back room in order to be a candidate herself. It's something she's mm-hmm. done with great reluctance. And on the excuse of her family not being ready, she's always avoided it. Mm-hmm. She has children, the youngest of whom has just gone off, one of the youngest daughter, which has just gone off to college, and she has a son still mm-hmm. at home.
And as an African-American woman, she has probably faced some barriers and obstacles that the other three women have not encountered.
Absolutely. It was tough enough being a woman when these women came into the working world. They start law school in the late 1970s and come into the working world in the early 1980s, in 1981. And that was a challenge in itself. But for it was a challenge to be African-American in a professional environment. It was a challenge to be a woman in a professional environment. To be an African-American woman was a particular hard road to hoe.
And she's a scholar of Latin.
She is a scholar of Latin. I will tell you that I speak no Latin and knew no Latin when I created Lainey. And so after I had finished the book, I thought, well, what am I going to do with all this Latin? Who knows if it's right? So I hired somebody to – I found a fellow who teaches Latin who was kind enough to look at it all for me. And then one of the funny things that happened on the way to the book becoming an audio is that the reader of the audio called me up to ask me how to pronounce a few things, one of which was all that Latin. And I just laugh. And I said, I haven't a clue, to be honest, but I know this really nice guy. And she called him and he walked through all the Latin translations with her, which was really terrific.
I'm glad to know the book is available on audio because I know many of our listeners prefer their books that way.
I love audiobooks. I listen to them all the time. Indeed, on my way here, I was listening to an audiobook.
And then our fourth character, Ginger, whose name is actually Virginia Cook Conrad. Tell us a little bit about Ginger.
Ginger comes from the wealthiest background and also from a background in which her mother is also a law school graduate, which it's unusual for these women to be in law school, but not as unusual as it was for Ginger's mother. Ginger's mother is a very prominent feminist lawyer. And Ginger, in many ways, has grown up in the shadow of her mother and struggling to try to find some space for herself in a life that has expectations she feels she can't live up to. She goes into the practice of law with a swanky New York firm. She ends up not being made partner and goes off to sort of lick her wounds. She has children and she becomes a stay-at-home mom and begins writing poetry. And it's through her poetry that she really, in some ways, comes to understand who she is.
And there is a lot of poetry in it seems almost as though Ginger thinks in poetry.
Ginger does very much think in poetry, and I'll tell you one of the reasons she does is because I love to read poetry, and if you have a character who is a poet and who thinks in lines of poetry sometimes, it gives you a great excuse to read poetry in the afternoon and call it work.
Mm-hmm. Are you a poet yourself?
I will tell you that the first thing I ever submitted to have published was a poem. I was in the eighth grade at the time, and my teacher had encouraged me to send out this poem. I sent it out to the one place that I knew published poetry at the time, which was Seventeen Magazine. It turns out Seventeen Magazine publishes poems by Pulitzer Prize-winning poets, and not often things written in purple ink on lined paper with little daisies dotting the I's. Not surprisingly, I got a rejection, and I concluded from that one rejection that I wasn't a writer and did not submit work for many, many years after that. And I have never submitted poetry since then. I have three published novels and I'm working on a fourth. I have many short stories, and yet the idea of poetry continues to intimidate me.
Do you think that's fairly common among very young writers to be so discouraged by their first rejection that they pull away from writing for a long time?
The way I grew up, my dad is an accountant. My mom is a homemaker. There were no writers, no artists of any type in my environment when I was growing up. And so my idea of writers was that they were people who could leap single literary buildings in single bounds. And when I failed to do that, with my first submission, I assumed that meant I wasn't a writer. I think that young people's egos are very fragile, and
yes,
certainly in middle school in particular, young people's egos are very fragile, and we can lose confidence in things even that we do well pretty easily.
I think that's a really important message for our listeners, young listeners, and also listeners who are parents and teachers, to encourage young people to continue to write, and that a rejection slip is only a sign that you've begun your career.
One of the things I do now is I host a blog. It's called First Books, Stories of How Writers Get Started. And just about every week I have some published author blogging about how they got started. And it is story after story of all the rejection that people faced on their way to getting published. Julia Glass, whose first novel, Three Junes, won the National Book Award. I thought she would be the one post where, yes, this is really an overnight success. She blogged about the 6 years she spent sending out short stories and never getting them published. It's a slow process sometimes, finding your way into print. And yet, when you get there, there is very little that's more satisfying.
Yes. And in your bio, you mention your husband as being the one who encouraged you when you were working as a corporate lawyer to get back to your writing.
My husband is really a wonderful man. My first advice to anybody who wants to write is to find a spouse who's as supportive as Mac is. He really did encourage me to write, and I will tell you that it's, you know, I told my boyfriend at the time that I submitted that poetry when I was a child that I wanted to be a writer, and I really didn't tell anybody that I even had that dream until after I'd married my husband. And I was coming home late at night from work. I was working really hard as a merger and acquisition lawyer. He was the one who came home to let the nanny go every day because he had a more reasonable job by then. And he asked me if sort of this was what I was going to do the rest of my life. And my response was, well, what else could I do other than practice law? And he said, just in your wildest dreams, is there anything else you'd like to do? And I said, well, yeah, in my wildest dreams, yes, I'd like to be a novelist, but that's going to happen. Ha, ha, ha. And he said, without missing a beat, well, how will you know if you can do it or not if you don't give it a try? It was really a gift to be able to try it and know that failure would be okay.
What a marvelous story. The story of the meeting of the four Miss Bradwells in law school, the same law school that you attended, I think, in Michigan, is, and you do note somewhere in your material that some of this material is autobiographical, so I don't feel that I'm stepping across too many lines, but if I am, just tell me. But it's 1979, the first day of law school, and these women haven't met, but through the process of questions and answers from the professor, they bond and call themselves the four Ms. Bradwells. Now I think it's time for you to tell us, who was Virginia Bradwell? Virginia, is that her name?
It's actually Myra Bradwell.
Myra, thank you.
And Myra Bradwell is actually a historic figure. There is an 1873 Supreme Court case called Bradwell versus the State of Illinois. And it is a case in which Mrs. Myra Bradwell is petitioning the State of Illinois to practice law. The State of Illinois says, nope, no lady lawyers in our state. And the Supreme Court backs up the State of Illinois. Nope, no lady lawyers in Illinois if they don't want lady lawyers. And they say, in a concurring opinion, Justice Joseph P. Bradwell says, the natural and proper timidity and delicacy which belongs to the female sex evidently unfits it for many of the occupations of civil life. The paramount destiny and mission of woman are to fulfill the noble and benign offices of wife and mother. This is the law of the Creator. So, see, it's God's fault that women can't be lawyers, not the Supreme Court's.
Isn't that astonishing?
Yeah.
So and you have that citation in the very front of the book so that the reader can begin with the story of Myra Bradwell.
With that perspective, exactly. The nickname, the Ms. Bradwells, is very much a tongue-in-cheek nickname. It is bestowed on them, really, on the opening day of law school. I will tell you that the biggest fiction in the book is probably the fact that on the first day of law school, the class discusses the Bradwell versus the State of Illinois, as opposed to Marbury versus Madison, which is where every constitutional law course in the country begins. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to be able to give them that nickname at the very beginning and have them have that bonding experience at the very beginning of law school. Mm-hmm. So they are all called on to answer questions by the professor. And when I went to law school, you still had to stand to answer questions. And so I will tell you that Mia, who is one of the people who stands to answer questions there, her knees are shaking like my knees shook when I was in law school the first time I had to stand to answer. But they discuss Bradwell versus Illinois, and they all do it quite well, actually. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that class, they are given the collective nickname, the Ms. Bradwells, and individual Bradwell nicknames as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's how they find each other, discover each other.
That is how they find each other. Right. They all stand to answer. And at the end of the class, Ginger stands by the door and kind of collects them and says, hey, well, we did that okay, didn't we? Mm-hmm. How about if we go study in the ARB together? And that's where the friendship begins.
The story begins. Virginia, Ginger, was very sassy to the professor.
Ginger is a sassy girl.
and she got away with it.
Ginger is an interesting mix of sassiness and insecurity in the way that I think many people who are sassy are that way, or humorous, or arrogant. Mm-hmm. Often that is a cover for some insecurity underneath. Mm-hmm. Ginger is very confident about some things. And one of the things she's fairly confident about is that she is a smart woman. She has been raised by Faith, who is the feminist lawyer who has raised her to be outspoken. And so she is. And when the professor repeatedly calls her Miss, she repeatedly corrects him, Ms. And when he apologizes, he's from the South, and he says, old dogs and new tricks and all that. Mm-hmm. She says, you don't look like such an old dog to me, Professor. So she does stand up for herself. One of the things that I found when I was doing research for the book, which I found really interesting was, I mean, Ms. seems like such a simple thing.
Yes.
You know, Mrs. and Miss, they both identify a woman first by her marital status. Before you even know her name, you know her marital status. And Ms. was just an effort to neutralize that. But it was an effort that wasn't even offered as an option by the New York Times until 1986. Those little things, which seem like such little things now, women being called women instead of girls, were seen as activist, almost militant feminism at the time, and challenging the status quo. And many people didn't want the status quo challenged, men and women.
Yes. Now, lest people think that this book is entirely about feminism, we'll talk about the plot. I work very hard never to give away the plot. So I will simply tell our listeners that at the end of this day of the hearing, when Betts is obviously a shoo-in, a question is raised that puts everything on hold. And the four Ms. Bradwells flee the press to an island that is just offshore, Cook Island, which is owned by Ginger's family. And then the rest of the book takes place in the next few days that they spend on Cook Island. There's a great deal in the past that comes up in this plot. There's a horrendous rape, a death which is either a murder or a suicide. But during the course of those few days, we really get to know these women and what they've been through and their hopes for the future and their regrets and their joys and their sorrows. And there is even a time when the trust among them is in danger because of what's at stake.
The characters do, the four Ms. Bradwells do come to D.C. with the intention of going and spending a weekend in New York together, just having a good time and helping Betts pass the time when she's waiting to be confirmed. Everybody other than Betts thinks she's a shoo-in and there's not going to be any issue about it. But then this skeleton does fall from their collective closet at the end of chapter one, and much of the book is spent trying to deny that skeleton is theirs, trying to put his old bones back in the ground, trying to dress him up in some way so that he doesn't look quite so skeletal, and ultimately dealing with the bones that have in some ways polluted their friendship and certainly polluted their lives and the choices they've made. Mm-hmm. It's a compliment to the love that they have for each other that they all don't know the story, because each of them knows particular parts of the story and they hold their parts to themselves in efforts to protect their friends. And the end result, of course, is that nobody gets protected and everybody gets hurt.
And their trust in each other is shaken just a bit.
Their trust in each other is shaken. There are moments when each of them wonders if the others have done something dreadful, inexcusable, but nonetheless untenable. They really do wonder at times whether their friendship will survive this second challenge to it. In some ways, their friendship didn't survive the earlier challenge. It was certainly scarred by the earlier challenge to it, the thing that happened when they were in law school together. And their friendship has kind of floated on the surface of that, not addressing that for the many years in between. One of the reasons it wasn't addressed for the many years in between is because they're afraid to know the truth. And so they choose to look away as opposed to looking at what the truth might be. Mm-hmm. And so in the course of the book, they come to gather the collective courage to look at the truth, decide what to do about it, and do something about it.
And Ginger's mother, Faith, the feminist attorney whose island it was before Ginger inherited it, becomes a more and more important character because she holds some of the keys to the mystery. I wondered about Ginger, the daughter of a famous feminist attorney. Sometimes in the process, people who are very powerful for causes, no matter how just the cause, their children suffer, their families suffer. And I think you brought out in a very subtle way that Ginger herself was harmed by her mother's career.
I don't know that I would say that Ginger was harmed by her mother's career so much as Ginger was harmed by the feeling that she had to be at least what her mother was and should be more. Her mother is somebody who grew up in the years when women didn't have very many opportunities, so she created something really special simply by going to law school and becoming a feminist lawyer. That is the bar that Ginger mm-hmm. sees as her starting point. Mm-hmm. And so she needs to do more than that. And honestly, it's hard to do more than some parents have done. And certainly if you are trying to make your way in their fields, it's mm-hmm. particularly hard.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ginger is a very complex character, full of conflicting emotions and drives, and as we learn her own personal story, we come to know her quite well.
Ginger is, in some ways, my favorite character in the book, and I rarely say that I have a favorite character, but Ginger is one of those people who, when you first meet her, you're not sure you're going to like her. She's a little abrasive. She's a little cocky in a way that makes you not necessarily trust her. And she is very, very competitive in a way that makes many people, and especially women, I think, nervous about whether she will be a good friend. But she also has a huge heart, mm-hmm. and she wants to do good for her friends and for the world. And I came to like her very much in the writing of her.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was very close to a woman a generation older than I who was one of the first attorneys to practice in Connecticut. She was admitted to Yale Law during the First World War because they needed to fill those seats in
yes.
Yale Law School. And I loved to listen to her story of those early days when she was so eager to practice law and wondering if she'd ever get a toehold in the profession. Some things are easier for women these days, and I think it's important that they know that the road has been a rocky one and that they stand on the shoulders of many, many fabulous women who fought the good fight.
That is absolutely right. And I will say also that I am actually a little bit younger than the four Ms. Bradwells. And
yes.
I started law school just a couple of years after they did. I came of age after the women's movement. I didn't have the benefits of Title IX when I was growing up, but I certainly had them by the time I was applying to college. And I took everything for granted. I thought the change had come and the doors were wide open and I was just going to march in and take over the world just like any man would. And it was a big surprise to me to find out that what was on the other side of that door were a lot of minefields. A lot of them have been detonated. A lot of women have taken the hit. But there are still plenty of landmines out there. And I think those become particularly apparent at the high levels. Women are half of law students now, but still only less than 20% of partners in law firms. They are still less than 25% of judges and less than 15% of general counsels. And the numbers in business, which you probably know, having an MBA, are mm-hmm. even worse.
Yes.
I mean, the number of women who are CEOs of Fortune 500 companies now are 8 out of 500, down from 12 a couple of years ago. So
amazing.
The challenges are still there. They are less obviously there, but there is a little bit of sort of an embedded gender presumption. Things like it's the mommy track, not the parent track, that continue to make it a challenge for women coming through the professions to find a way that works.
Yes. We're still holding up half the world.
We are still holding up at least half the world.
doing our best.
Exactly.
Meg, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you about many, many things and about your book, The Four Ms. Bradwells. And I understand that it's doing very well. It's available in bookstores, in the libraries. There's an audio book of it. You can get it online. And I urge you to do so and to read this a very, very interesting story of these four amazing women.
Thank you very much. You can also get my my second novel, The Wednesday Sisters, in paperback, and my first novel as well, The Language of Light, has just come out in paperback.
Yes, I meant to mention The Language of Light. I enjoyed that so much as well. And there's a lot in there about photography. I wondered, are you a photographer?
I am not a photographer, but if I had any talent at it, I might be.
Well, maybe another career.
Maybe so.
And I hope that someday you will write your own story, write your memoir, because I think your readers would find it most interesting.
Oh, but then I would have to tell the truth.
Good point.
You've been listening to Rosemary Manchester in conversation with Meg Waite Clayton about her latest book, The Four Ms. Bradwells. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. It's a novel idea.
Just as a leaf takes flight, discovering gravity, I feel the need to
Manchester. He's an oil painter, a commercial illustrator, and now a best-selling author of two books. He hails from the Canadian Maritime Province of New Brunswick and is working on an illustrated novel, which you can check out online. We'll hear more about this in my conversation with Peter Manchester. Coming up next, it's a novel idea.
Peter Manchester?
Yes.
You are an artist working in
Sackville, New Brunswick.
And where on the planet is that?
That's at the very tip of the Bay of Fundy. So if you followed the Bay of Fundy past the main coast, it would form into, two tines of a fork. If you took the left-hand side, you would end up pretty much in Sackville.
You are a painter. Yes.
Yes, that's correct.
And I've seen some of your paintings via your website and found that your oil paintings seem so striking in their depiction of nature.
I'm kind of old-fashioned when it comes to oil painting because to me it really is a craft. I distance myself somewhat from the emotional part of the painting. And to me, the representation is very important. I consider myself more in the mindset of like John Singer Sargent, you know, some of the earlier painters of the late 19th, early 20th century.
I noticed you had a series that was all about an imagining of a planet with no animals.
Oh yeah, I did a series on the evolution of trees. And so I always thought that it would be an interesting intellectual exercise to give trees much higher sentient power and look at them in their evolutionary process, which to us is almost glacial. It just happens in such a long stretch of time. For example, when a tree decides to die, it might take 100 years to do so. So I thought that you would have none of this cinematic drama that we associate in day to day stuff, but trees would enact their battles over many years and decades if they indeed do decide to fight, and I've sort of dealt with that, but also imagining trees developing the power to fly, to move about at will. I love painting trees, but it was a really fun exercise to go through.
And maybe some of our listeners might like to view some of these and experience that. Where can they do that?
They can do that at my website, which is petermanchester.ca. And there's a small link on the lower left-hand side that says Evolution of Trees. And there's a little bit of a descriptor with each image.
What was the medium? Was that oil painting?
Those are all oil.
Yeah. And do you work exclusively in oil?
No, I'm also an illustrator, and so there's times when I work in watercolor. I do a lot of work with digital imaging on my computer, and I work with a Wacom tablet. There's no true way to do an image, you know, in the old-fashioned way of you know, working on sketches and then, you know, bringing them up to a much larger scale as you would pre-computer times. I use the computer a lot to work out composition issues because I can scale and move things about. I can work with tonality. But then when it comes down to the actual painting, it's pretty much just oil paint and brush and spending the time on the easel.
That's interesting that you use the technology as a sketch pad in a way.
All through Europe in the 1800s, every art supply store had this huge bank of photographs of models and whatever. And so you could actually, you know, find small black and white photographs to look at, you know, the way different models are positioned, bending over, whatever. And really it was kind of like what we would envision on Google Images in a much smaller scale, but those reference materials were available to them. And so photography, really, for over 150 years, you know, painters have been using photography as a reference material, except now it's much different because we can access such a huge amount of imagery and we can manipulate it to such a degree. The biggest developments in art, in my opinion, have happened in the graphic arts. And if you look at sort of like the Dada movement from you know, early 20th century on, that random sampling of things and putting them into a composition, and the way, you know, it's altered our aesthetic. To me, some of the most compelling visual imagery has come from the illustration world, rather than the big dollar salons of New York or wherever.
Something also accessible and visually satisfying.
Yes, but it's also with child's. A lot of illustration, of course, is done for children's literature, but the need to engage and to compel a young mind is really it's a very difficult thing, and you really have to have very animated. I think kids have a BS detector that's pretty good, and they can see what's genuine and what isn't, and so that a lot of the great work, looking at the stuff from N.C. Wyeth, you know, which really was painted for, you know, 12-year-old boys and whatever, but really it still satisfies an enormous population. His work to me is still pure genius, but the way that he would do his research and the way that he would incorporate all these different elements into it, and you know, it's these basic rules of composition that have existed since the Renaissance. There's just treasure troves to be found in his images.
Amazing. Well, you know, there is that range in your work, and now you have these books. Tell us a little bit about your books.
Well, the history of those books actually is quite funny, because it really defies any way that anyone ever gets a book deal. Working as an illustrator, freelance illustrator for Goose Lane Editions, which is one of the, to me, in my estimation, one of the finer small book publishers in Canada. And they really have a great list of authors, and I'd encourage anyone to look them up online. As an illustrator, what you're always looking for is a big sort of body of work. And so you hate to do just the one or two off images. You really want, you know, you want a big, heady project. And so I thought, oh, what could we do with this? And so I'm always have been a recycler, and I play around with, you know, discards and that sort of thing. And so I saw that living in Canada, there was just lots and lots of hockey sticks. Hockey sticks figure large in the do-it-yourself world up there, but it's mostly
that's for real. You're not making that
up. Yeah, I'm not making
that
it
really
up.
Hockey is that embedded in the culture Well, I don't know. I grew up in Cleveland, and growing up, we had lots of hockey sticks in the house.
It's there, and any garage has multiple sticks, either in good form or broken. But usually when they break, it's they go to hold up a tomato plant or to fix something in the cottage or something like that. And so I wanted to take it in a different direction. And so I came up with a few projects and I wrote up some brief text, about 100 words for each project. And I sent it to the woman who's the art director there. And she goes, wow, this is great. Where'd it come from? And I said, well, I'm kind of working on this project. What do you think? She goes, I think this is good. Send us the manuscript. And of course, I had nothing, right? I had like about a half a dozen things. And so then I said, I'm putting the polish on it. I'll get it to you pretty soon. So it was a mad scramble. And then really, we fleshed out different ideas. And actually, the first book.
Yes, tell us the names of these books and the order you've written them in.
Well, the first one was called 50 Things to Make with a Broken Hockey Stick. And so it came out at a very opportune time. And actually, it was a Canadian bestseller for a while, which doesn't mean a whole lot because the book market in Canada can be quite small in that genre. Nonetheless, it made it was in the top 10 list.
And it demanded a sequel.
And so unfortunately for the sequel, it was the year that the NHL decided to go on strike. And so everything was in place for the big book tour, and I did tour a lot across Canada with that. But even if you had like Wayne Gretzky's jersey, no one was going to buy it. It's just, people were sick and tired of the way that the hockey players and team owners were acting. And so nothing was moving in the hockey world.
So they took it out on you. And the name of that sequel is Fabulous Fabrications from Busted Hockey Gear.
From Busted Hockey Gear. And actually, I still think there's some great inventions in there, and I participate in this program. It's the Writers in the School program in New Brunswick. It's to bring writers into public schools to show that you're not just doing novels, you're not just doing the expected, and that I consider my book to some degree technical writing, and it's a real challenge to instruct people clearly on how to accomplish a project. And I took pride in the fact that I could do this. You take a hockey stick and cut it, and then 10 steps later you have a guitar, or something like that. But there was lots of territory that I used later. I mined heavily for other writing projects from the Fabulous Fabrications from Busted Hockey Gear book.
I would love to have you read something. Do you have a favorite story or something that...
Maybe something from the beginning. Okay, so here goes. Skating on the first ice of winter, hockey stick in hand, makes a person feel like an artist gazing out on a newly gessoed canvas. Anything is possible. The most outrageous maneuvers seem attainable. The season brims with possibilities. Sadly, gravity, dexterity, and a host of other factors chip away at our fantasy, and reality comes calling. An aspiring athlete feels the inequality between ourselves and the pros. Yet every last player in the NHL uses the same tools and equipment available to the local rink rat. Of course, the professional player's skates and stick might cost many hundreds of dollars, and the uniforms and padding are all customized and therefore very expensive. But every hockey player has a hockey stick that is much like everyone else's. Research shows that the price is the number one factor in buying a hockey stick. Most of us are cheapskates, cheap sticks, but no matter how much we pay, every stick can end up broken and discarded. And from that point, I take on this one, I guess like all these how-to books, they somehow seem to end at 50 or something like that. 100 seems too much. And so the publisher says, no, 50 for now, give them 50 later. And so that's kind of what happens with these books. Anyway, so I mine heavily on whimsy and other implausible things made with hockey sticks, even geodesic domes. And some of these projects are really downright silly. But you can even make a global positioning stick with a hockey stick and find your way in the world.
So you've combined a lot of your own personal, the sense of whimsy.
Whimsy,
and
yeah.
The culture of Canada is all woven in there.
Well, it's... I've moved many times in my life, and so I've always been a newcomer wherever I go. And because of that, I think it helps to focus your skills and observation and what makes a difference, because you really need to discern what the differences are before you can fit in. You need to see the otherness before you can generate that sameness with them. And so for me, moving to Canada was it opened up a lot of possibilities because from a distance, we really are pretty close cousins between Canada and the U.S. But on closer scrutiny, there's a whole lot of difference between what happens on one side of the border and what happens on the other. And it's evident, and if anybody who follows politics or social life or whatever, I could mine that quite a lot. I could find a lot of things to play around with. But also, it's just, I think it's just making fun of human nature too. It's not, I'm not singling out anyone. It's just like, hey, look at this. And I love to come up with new ideas. And as far as anybody who's a writer, even an artist, list making is really important in the creative process. And so a lot of these things were really just, it's, you know, you're always making, you know, this will work, this won't work, whatever.
Lots of fun.
It was a lot of fun, and it still is a lot of fun, and I still am involved in the second book, Fabulous Fabrications from Busted Hockey Gear. There was one section where I was making hockey masks, and that is I was taking hockey helmets and taking them apart and then recreating masks out of them. And one of the reasons I was doing that was that in a lot of professional sports, people are very they love to have rituals. They think that there's a lot of magic in what they do. They're superstitions. They'll wear the same pair of socks. They'll drive the same way to the rink. Again, that's superstition. And so I've thought that wherever there's superstition, there's a belief system that's worth looking into and worth tweaking. So the superstition and just the tradition of masks in literature and in art to me seem like a good place to mine ideas and to come up with a storyline.
Where can people buy your books?
They can buy my books on Amazon. I'm not sure who's carrying it. These books, I know Walmart just bought out Goose Lane for the Stanley Cup playoffs, so they might look there. I think rather than drive down there and hoping that they have it, I think Amazon might be the best place to take a look for it. And again, the titles are 50 Things to Make with a Broken Hockey Stick and Fabulous Fabrications from Busted Hockey Gear.
Wonderful. What are you working on now? On your website, it talked about a graphic novel.
I've spun off into another really interesting genre, and that is the creation of forgotten maritime comic book heroes. Anyway, I've always loved comics. A few years ago, I was in Australia, and they had it was Darwinian. They had this entire genre of comics down there called Bonzer comics, and it was really they developed on their own with, you know, someone saw them in North America, and they said, hey, we should try this. And they had amazing characters that's loosely parallel ours, but they're different. They've, you know, Australia has given its, you know, its polish to it. And so, again, in the Maritimes, I thought the Maritimes, I'm including Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and Newfoundland. And so it is to some degree, people in Canada feel it's a forgotten part of Canada. You know, all the action is happening, you know, in the central part and out west. And so I have been painting characters of, again, forgotten comic book heroes. I guess the most well-known right now is this character I came up with named Lobsterella, and she's the avenging queen of Crustacea, and she I guess she kicks butt on lobster fishermen, but they're large format paintings, you know, 3 feet by 5 feet.
I saw them on your website.
Yeah, and yes. Anyway, they're really, really fun to paint, and I just finished a new painting called The Crimson Canoeist. And she's in this canoe called the Chestnut Canoe, which was, if anybody loves canoeing, they'll know, you know, Chestnut, Peterborough, some of these other brands that are based on the L.L. Bean model, you know, cedar strip canvas. And but somehow she has a magic canoe that can take her into space and fight aliens and that sort of thing. But I've worked up about a dozen comic book covers, because I find that painting the covers is the most fun part. and that was and again, if I can just kind of backtrack to the back graphic novel part, the idea part is really it's sort of like, you know, it's like prepping a meal, it's like cooking, you know, all the wonderful stuff is happening on the upfront part, and then but you know, to actually flesh out the story, that's like doing the dishes. You know what I mean? It's just it's really that's the hard part. And so I feel like I'm cheating to some degree by just taking the glory at the front end. On the other hand, there are backstories involved with these, but to come up with, you know, the big backstory, that's work.
Got it. Now, I wanted to ask you, since you did mention that these books were bestsellers and that you toured Canada, and can you tell us a little bit about what you know about the Canadian publishing industry?
The Canadian publishing industry is pretty vibrant in the context of Canada, and that a lot of the bigger authors do make it. You know, they become sort of like North American writers, you know, and names that we're all familiar with, like Michael Ondaatje and Margaret Atwood, of course, would be one. And there are, you know, book fairs. The town close to me, Moncton, New Brunswick, has the Northrop Frye Festival, and they have, you know, bring in a lot of Canadian writers and international writers. Having said that, it's a bilingual country. And so Quebec has a very vibrant publishing industry, but on a very small scale. A publisher would probably put out safely 2,500 to 5,000 copies of the first run and then see how it goes. But there's still the Canadian Council for the Arts is supportive of writers, artists, poets, whatever. There is money to get around once a book is published. There's always every publisher has some government help to get keep things going.
Interesting, because in this country, it seems like we were more that way maybe in the 60s.
Yeah.
And or at least I have the perception that we don't support the arts the way we did at one time. Yet in Canada, it seems like it's something that's really valued. Or is that just that kind of over-the-border envy?
It's like this. In Canada, most working artists in Canada at some point have benefited from the Canadian government, Canada Council grants, or provincial grants. And they are very good at getting artists in schools, getting people's work out there, supporting nonprofit galleries, supporting public galleries, and helping keep the arts alive.
Thank you for coming in, and I wanted to ask you a little bit more though about your background.
My background. As you know, my mother has a book show at this station, and she is a voracious reader. She's helped instill a love of books in me, but she still is the all-time champion reader because just she can plow through so much so quickly and retain so much information from that. And so she's always been a wonderful source of literature in my life because she knows what I love to read, and it usually boxes of books usually show up my way. And so we're spread far afield, but we try and stay close, and we all share a love of literature.
So thanks.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
That was Peter Manchester, Canadian artist who was passing through the area and stopped in the studio. And finally today, Barbara Quick, author of Vivaldi's Virgins and The Golden Web, brings us her review of Gary Steingart's super sad true love story.
Not to love and lavish praise on Gary Steingart's new novel would almost seem to be an act of cultural heresy. Anointed by The New Yorker as one of the 20 best writers under 40, Steingart has entered a literary empyrean where he enjoys immunity to the slings and arrows of grumpy readers. And yet, I am not in love with his novel, Super Sad True Love Story, which just came out in paperback. Even though Michiko Kakutani of The New York Times hailed it as one of the 10 best books of 2010. Steingart's novel is set in a future that seems just around the corner, in an America run by corporations and owned by China. Crypto-fascism and illiteracy prevail. Sexuality has become a thoroughly public matter, arbitrated by the fashion industry and a Facebook descendant called Global Teen, which relentlessly publishes ratings of everyone's, I can't say the word on the radio, let us say, doability. A literary heir to Woody Allen's nerdy protagonist in Sleeper, Steingart's alter ego, Lenny Abramoff, finds himself struggling and adrift in this morally and literally bankrupt world, looking for love and hoping for immortality. Gary Steingart has made literary hay out of being washed onto these shores in the latest wave of Russian Jewish immigrants to parents he both resents and reveres. A desire to understand the immigrant experience in all the glory of its possibilities for angst and humor is the heart and soul, at least so far, of Steingart's imaginative quest. Super Sad True Love Story is a postmodern hodgepodge of emails, diary entries, and first-person narrative, all of it larded over with irony as thick as the layer of fat on my mother's brisket. Call me old-fashioned, but I like a story with characters I don't want to leave when the book is done. Characters who are more than caricatures, more than a set of funhouse mirrors in service of the author's gift for satire. Steingart himself invokes the term hysterical realism to describe his writing style. My beef with him is that, like his heroes Tolstoy and Chekhov, the man really can write. Ironically, he's written the sort of end-of-literature novel that both he and his alter ego, Lenny Abramoff, decry. I want this clearly brilliant writer to gird himself up and take more risks, to do his part to keep alive the literary novel that he and I both love so well.
That was author Barbara Quick, who you can hear regularly every Wednesday night with her reviews and commentaries. Want to thank Meg Waite Clayton, the author of The Four Ms. Bradwells, Peter Manchester, author of 50 Things to Make with a Broken Hockey Stick, and Fabulous Fabrications from Busted Hockey Gear. Rosemary Manchester will be back next month. It's our annual book festival show, so I hope you'll tune in then Wednesday, September 14th, right here on KRCB. I'm Suzanne Lang.
And I'm Rosemary Manchester. And remember, there's no such thing as too many books.